And good morning. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It is Monday morning. My name is Beth Pike, and today our host, Latara Smith, is going to be talking with the appellate lawyer, Kent Gibson. And they're going to talk about criminal appeals process and the appellate system on the federal and state level. In the second half of the broadcast, though, we are also going to be replaying an interview. It was from back in March of 2014, and Jessica Thomas did this with Dean Becker of the 420 Drug War News and other radio and TV shows, as well as he's an author of the book To End the War on Drugs, A Guide for Politicians, the Press, and the Public. You'll want to stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast. And then, of course, we've got our 420 Drug War News at the end of the show. But up next is Latara and her guest.
Hi, my name is Latara Smith. I'm with the Casey Freedom Project, and today I'm your host on the Jaws of Justice radio show. You're listening to KKFI 90.1 FM, and we would like to thank you for tuning in this morning. This morning, I have the privilege and the honor to interview a very, very well-known attorney here in Kansas City, Missouri. We are interviewing a Mr. Kent Gibson today. Mr. Gibson, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show with me today. I appreciate having you here.
I'm glad to help you out. Thank you.
Awesome. Mr. Gibson, can you tell us just a little bit about you? And I know that you're an awesome attorney, but can you tell us just a little bit more in specific about what you do and your legal expertise and maybe some of your educational experiences and things like that?
All right. I've been a criminal defense lawyer for the last 32 years. When I was a young lawyer, I was a public defender in Jackson County. Then I started working a lot on death penalty cases, a lot in the late 80s and through the 90s, when that was the death penalty was a lot more popular than it is now. And the last, I don't know, 15 or 20 years, I've sort of specialized in post-conviction litigation to try to, particularly in cases where I think the innocent have been convicted, which the DNA revolution has opened the eyes of a lot of people, that there
right.
were a lot more innocent people in prison than anybody in the public or even in the criminal justice system would like to admit. And it's still a very uphill battle to try to get an innocent man out of prison. It's a lot harder than it should be.
Right. Well, let me ask you something real quick, because you said something that a lot of our listeners may not know what that means. What do you mean by post-conviction relief?
Well, and post-conviction appeals are just what it means. After someone's convicted, you normally have what's called a direct appeal, where you challenge the fairness of your trial based on errors supposedly committed by the judge or the prosecution in admitting evidence or jury instructions, things like that. If you lose your direct appeal, then you have a post-conviction appeal, which is called in Missouri, we call it a 2915, where you usually litigate issues involving the effectiveness of your trial lawyer, or if there was some exculpatory evidence that wasn't disclosed, it would be claims that are outside of the record of the trial. And you should have an opportunity, although not always, to have a hearing and put on any additional evidence to support your claim that you were wrongfully convicted. Once that's completed, you have a right within a year to go into federal court to file what's called a federal habeas corpus petition. However, about 20 years ago, as part of the Anti-Terrorism Act, that in the wake of the Oklahoma City bombing, they've really limited that remedy. It was designed to speed up death row appeals, but it applies to everyone, whether you have the death penalty or not, and it makes it very difficult for a federal court to overturn a state court conviction. So,
right.
And once you complete that process, you're pretty much done with your normal review. And if you're on death row, that's when you're likely to face a serious execution date. And your options, if you don't succeed on any of those appeals, are limited. And particularly the sort of perverse thing about it is both Missouri courts and the federal courts, particularly in this circuit, say you cannot raise a claim of innocence in a 2915 or in a federal habeas. It's only limited to whether you got a fair trial or something unconstitutional about your conviction. So that's really and it just underscores, I think, that there's not an adequate process in Missouri for courts to hear claims of innocence.
Right, right. And it doesn't appear to be. Most definitely not. It most definitely doesn't appear to be. Now, people don't understand that once, you know, that gavel is slammed down to that desk there and it comes, the conviction comes across as guilty or however they do it, it is quite a long process for, you know, people think, oh, I'm found guilty, I'm going to file my appeal, I'm going to walk out these doors out of my appeal, it's going to be turned around. But many, many, many times it does not happen like that. And people don't understand how much time it takes. You know, when we see cases where there's, you know, 10, 20 years of people fighting to get out, you know, this is reality with these post-conviction process. You know, I mean, what do you think could help that long time, all these years of litigation, to be cut down? Are you familiar? I know I just asked you, what did you think could help it? But are you familiar with conviction integrity units?
Yes. A lot of major cities, prosecutors or district attorneys or whatever they call them in the particular jurisdiction have started these units, and they're basically, it's sort of like the best analogy I can sort of think of is it's sort of like an internal affairs is to the police department. They're supposed to be insulated from some of the politics of the office, which everybody's got to keep in mind that prosecutors almost everywhere are politicians, and
right,
a lot of people we see is in Congress and the Senate got their starts as prosecutors, and so politics infects the whole, that issues of justice all the time, but particularly in the past with the tough on crime mentality that a prosecutor would be extremely hesitant, particularly if they have future political ambitions, to free someone who's been convicted if they think there's evidence of innocence, because their political opponents could use that against them. I think fortunately the climate is changing from probably the height of the anti-crime hysteria and draconian laws that were in effect in the 90s, and I think a lot of people of all political stripes realize that we have a broken criminal justice system. But a conviction integrity unit would be a unit of prosecutors who all they do is review older convictions from that county or jurisdiction and determine whether they believe this person is innocent,
right,
and was wrongly convicted. And they would have the power to do something about it, which would be to agree to have the conviction overturned and either free the person or, at the very minimum, allow a new trial where all the evidence of the person's innocence could be heard. So far, at least in Missouri, which has never been on the forefront of anything progressive in my lifetime, and since I've been born and raised here all my life, there's no such thing in Missouri. But we're hoping that at least in Kansas City and St. Louis, they would be amenable to this, because I think it's really a necessary thing, particularly in light of what I mentioned earlier, that oftentimes the post-conviction review process in Missouri does not provide an adequate forum for someone to litigate their innocence in the courts. So I think that would be a very, very worthwhile thing to have in every major city, and
right,
for that matter, in every county in the state, although they wouldn't have the manpower to do that in smaller counties.
Right, right.
Perhaps the Attorney General's office could get involved in that sort of situation. But that's catching on, and I think it's in light of the fact that everybody knows now that there are some studies that say as many as, you know, 5 or 10% of everyone in prison are innocent.
Right.
And when you have that level of error, if it's 4 out of 100 or 8 out of 100, that's there's got to be something in the system to rectify these mistakes.
Right. Well, you know, that is one, you know, as an advocate for the wrongly convicted and having a very dear friend that's wrongly convicted and in prison, you know, pushing for the Conviction Integrity Unit is most definitely something that, you know, I have 100% stood behind. And it was shocking to me when I came here to Missouri and began to speak with state reps and, you know, different individuals about Conviction Integrity Units. No one knew about it. No one was familiar with them at all. And, you know, I would not have even known about a Conviction Integrity Unit had I not had connection to the unit that was in Dallas that was established by Craig Watkins there. He has a very, very, he started a very successful Conviction Integrity Unit that has been responsible for releasing several individuals there in Texas who were wrongly convicted. And, you know, we are hoping and praying that, you know, we will be able to, you know, get one of those units established here, because it's very important. It not only can cut back on some time, but it can also save some expenses, because many of the people that are wrongly convicted that are sitting in prison, you know, they already, you know, if you're lacking resources to have money on your books and get the things that you need in prison and make phone calls, and you're most definitely lacking financial resources to retain, you know, an attorney to fight all of this post-conviction and relief, because we know that it can be, you know, very costly. So we're hoping and praying and believing that our prosecutor's office here will be open, you know, to the implementation of a Conviction Integrity Unit and be that lead, you know, be that lead for the other counties in Missouri to say, look, we took it on first and look what we're doing. Look at the difference that we're making in the lives of those that are here in Jackson County. Because, you know, you also have to understand that it not only costs the person who's wrongly convicted quite a bit of money to fight, you know, all of the post-conviction relief, but it costs us taxpayers a lot of money to house these people who are wrongly convicted. We're paying for nothing. And so I just see it could be a win-win for everyone, most definitely. Now, Mr. Gibson, do different circuit or district courts use different proceedings to inform their rulings?
Well, in Missouri, if you complete your normal post-conviction process and lose, then there's the only real avenue you have is the old common law writ of habeas corpus that Missouri follows. You have to start out and file in the circuit where you're incarcerated, and then you can take it to the Court of Appeals and then to the Missouri Supreme Court. The problem with it is that it's a totally discretionary writ, and
right.
The courts don't have to hold hearings. They don't even have to, in most cases, even issue a written opinion explaining why or why your case lacks merit or does have merit. They usually just issue one-line orders denying the petition, and that really gives you very little mechanism. You don't have the right to appeal. You just file it in the next highest court. And from my experience, it's frustrating, and I've seen it time and time again.
Right.
Is you'll have a very, very strong case. So you'll file a very detailed petition with a lot of affidavits and statements from new witnesses or witnesses who did testify, who admit they lied in court or were pressured by the police or prosecutors to lie. And you'll file the petition. I had one recently where I filed a very detailed case. All the witnesses against this man have recanted. I filed it in the Court of Appeals on I believe a Tuesday afternoon.
Well,
and
I've
by
heard about
10
that.
O'clock the next morning, they'd issued
denied.
A one-line denial. And it wouldn't have been humanly possible unless the court or their law clerks had pulled an all-nighter for them to have carefully reviewed this case. And it's maddening to think that someone in that situation would not get more of a fair process to prove their innocence.
Well, in a situation like that, because I most definitely know the individual you're referring to, what would be his next option?
Well, now since he's lost in the Court of Appeals, the only place he has left to go is the Missouri Supreme Court.
Okay.
And at least they do not do that. And from my experience, all three of the intermediate Court of Appeals, the one in St. Louis, the one here in Kansas City, and the one in Springfield, the Southern District, I've had the same experience in all three of them. You could file a petition, and less than 24 hours later, it's denied in a one-sentence order with no explanation as to why they took the action they took. And then when they don't write an opinion, there's really nothing for a higher court to review. So it makes it you don't know whether they denied it on a procedural technicality or if they denied it because they weren't convinced that you had enough to prove your innocence, but there's no way of knowing, and you don't have any right to a hearing. And at the process at the circuit court level, there's a practice that is being challenged in the U.S. Supreme Court in a case that may be heard out of, I believe, Alabama or Florida, where the attorney generals prepare the orders for the judge to sign denying the petition. And it's just basically a rubber stamp. And the counties where prisons are housed, I think the circuit judges are pretty jaded because they do get a lot of frivolous prison litigation. But I think because of that, they're not impacts the way they look at even guys who have very strong cases that they were wrongfully convicted, and they have what they call prison dockets, and one day a month, they'll shoot through all these prisoner cases, and more often than not, the attorney general will be asked to draft an order for the judge to sign, and that's what happens. And if ordinary civil litigants were treated the way convicts are in their challenges to their convictions, there'd be calls for impeachment of judges and
right.
all sorts of outrage. But of course, prisoners don't have lobbyists, so like trial lawyers and corporations, and they can get away with a double standard of treating convicts unfairly when they try to challenge their convictions.
Right. Right. Well, everyone, you are listening to the Jaws of Justice radio show. I'm your host, Latara Smith of the Casey Freedom Project. Today, I am interviewing Mr. Kent Gibson. He is a local attorney here in Kansas City, Missouri. And we are just speaking on the subject of post-conviction relief and all of these different types of motions and things that are filed in order to help those who are wrongly convicted to have their issues addressed in court with the possibility of them being released from prison. So we thank you all for tuning in. Mr. Gibson, now, there has been quite a bit, you know, we've had a lot of people that have been being released throughout various cities. I mean, if you know, I don't know if you're on Facebook quite a bit, but it seems like every week you've got two or three people who their cases are being overturned. You know, we have individuals that are being released through conviction integrity units. We've had some, you know, prosecutors or judges that said, you know what, hey, you know, enough is enough. Reverse the conviction, you know. And we're seeing a lot of it, and I, you know, it's kind of we're happy, but it's also kind of like, wow, what's going on? When you see all these cases where individuals are in prison for 20 years, 25 years, you know, and they've been saying from day one, I'm innocent, I'm innocent, I'm innocent, and some of these are actually coming through, you know, from the other innocence projects and things like that. But a lot of them are coming as a result of the conviction integrity unit. So we don't have very, very we don't have a lot of time left. So I wanted to ask you, I want you to kind of recap a few things. And most definitely, I need you to give out your information in case we have someone listening that wants to contact your office for assistance with their loved one's case and wrongful conviction.
There was just a case in the Sunday Star today of a guy in Texas who was exonerated, and he's been in since the early 90s, and the prosecutors and the police pressured his co-defendants to lie on him because they were promised probation, and then when as soon as they reneged on that and sent them to prison as well, they recanted. But it took him 23 years to be exonerated, which that's just unacceptable.
Did he come through a conviction integrity unit, or?
I don't think so. I know it was in Texas, but I don't think it was in Dallas. But
okay.
I think there ought to be a way, and I think either through the legislation or the Missouri Supreme Court can amend their rules of criminal procedure or post-conviction procedure to allow someone who has a claim of innocence to actually file a motion or a petition in the court that convicted him.
Right.
And have a hearing. And if that hearing is denied, if post-conviction relief or a new trial is denied, he ought to have the right to appeal it to Missouri appellate courts. Without that sort of process, in Missouri, it's a crapshoot as to whether someone who's wrongfully convicted can get a fair hearing and get released. I think, for instance, the Ryan Ferguson case, the guy who's now got a new MTV show, I think if he hadn't come from a fairly prosperous family I'm sure they spent a lot of money and then also did a very extensive media campaign.
Exactly.
He probably would still be in prison.
Right.
And of course, you know, it doesn't hurt that he is not a minority or someone from the city who has no resources and is a lot of people are languishing in prison and they don't have family or loved ones with the resources to attack the conviction. And the Innocence Projects through in Missouri and throughout the country do the best they can, but
right.
They're backlogged with these cases. And something needs to be done on a local level, particularly in the major metropolitan areas, to allow these cases to be heard and to be heard without someone having to languish in prison for 20 or 30 years.
Right.
Because the last person that I have gotten out was originally on death row and then serving a life sentence from a conviction that happened in the late 80s, and he got out about 5 years ago.
Right.
He was in prison for nearly 30 years.
Right.
And before he was exonerated, and that's just unacceptable.
Right. It is. It really is. Well, Mr. Gibson, we want you to get your contact information out because we're nearing the end of the show, and I want people to have that information on you.
My name is Kent Gibson, and that's G-I-P as in Paul, S-O-N. You can reach me. You can either Google me and get all my information from my website, but my phone number is 816-363-4400. And my office is in Kansas City, Missouri, but I do cases all over the state of Missouri in state and federal court, and have actually even done some cases in a few other states. But it's sort of there are not very many people who do this type of work.
Right.
So most criminal defense lawyers, you know, go to court every day on relatively minor criminal sort of things, and I specialize in a lot more complex types of cases, and they can be time-consuming. It can take years to litigate one of these cases.
Right,
I've have clients now that I've represented for 10 or 15 years and are still trying to get them out of prison. And it's just it's a frustrating process, but every now and then justice prevails and something good happens.
Right.
It should happen a lot more often.
Right. Well, we would like to thank you for coming on the show. It's been a blessing to interview you today. Everyone, thank you for tuning in. JT&T for Life. Have a blessed day.
Now, the calendar for August 22nd. Amnesty KC will hold their monthly meeting on Tuesday, August 23rd, 7 p.m. at the downtown Kansas City Public Library, 14 West 10th Street, KCMO, in room 310. This will be a planning meeting for their upcoming Refugee Rights event. The purpose of the event will be to bring awareness to the global refugee crisis, mainly that in Syria. CORI's network provides immediate services to families surviving homicide, such as advocacy, connection to community support, and other needs. Corey's Network, and Chuck E. Cheese are teaming up to raise funds to help families of murder victims bury their loved ones. Thursday, August 25th, from 3 to 9 p.m. at the Chuck E. Cheese store, 18701 East 39th Street, Independence, Missouri. Corey's Network will receive 15% of all food and game sales from the proceeds going to help bury victims of violence. The Black Archives of Mid-America and One Struggle KC invites you to learn legal ways to interact with and or film the police while protecting your rights. Their guest speaker is Mustafa Abdullah, lead organizer at the ACLU of Missouri. This event will be Tuesday, August 30th, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Black Archives, 1722 East 17th Terrace, KCMO. Please reserve your spot online at blackarchives.org and click on the Events tab at the top of the page. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. Coming up next is an interview from March of 2014 that host Jessica Thomas did with Dean Baker of the 420 Drug War News and author of the book To End the War on Drugs, A Guide for Politicians, the Press, and Public.
Good morning. I'm your host, Jessica Thomas, on today's edition of Jaws of Justice Radio. We interview Dean Baker, and Dean has hosted more than 1,000 Pacifica radio programs and is host of the Unvarnished Truth television program. The people who use substances prohibited 100 years ago by charlatans, moralists, and profiteers. The drug war is ending. It's a slow, ugly, and bloody, but it's ending. Politicians are walking away from this policy on a daily basis. The media has begun to open their eyes to the horrors we inflict on ourselves via drug prohibition, and the public is beginning to rise up against this war, the war on we the people. Is Dean joining me on the line this morning from Houston?
Good morning, Jessica. It feels like I'm at home. The same number, 90.1 FM, same as I do here in Houston on KPFT. And you guys follow Democracy Now! What a wonderful place to have a show.
It is, indeed, because it brings up a heightened sense of the issues that are going on. Amy's really good at bringing things to our consciousness.
Yes, I appreciate this opportunity. As you say, I've done well over 1,000 radio shows in this regard, trying to educate and motivate people to realize this drug war has no end. It has no need to exist, and we need to end it. We need to better protect our children from the horrors of drug war.
And you don't really well protect your children when they're, if you're a, you know, someone that needs a medical cannabis or any other substance user, and the jackbooted thugs come kicking the door down in the middle of the night.
Right.
Which
right.
leads to a lot of unnecessary deaths.
I use that, facetious bumper on my show, kicking in the door, we shall bring salvation, kicking in the door. And the fact of the matter is, the drug war has never protected our children. It has never protected our nation. It is a trap. It is a means whereby certain people make a lot of money and control the rest of us.
Some people refer to this as the new plantation.
Well, yes, it has a lot of similarities to the old Jim Crow situation, where we have a lot of people, a lot of black and Hispanic people, being sent to prison for minor amounts of drugs, and there they get, quote, jobs, making 6 cents an hour, making knickknacks for the prison guards union. It's such an ugly situation. And because it's been around for 100 years, since the Harrison Narcotics Act, that it must be valid. But the fact is, it has never done anything that it was purported to do.
I woke up one morning, and it was almost like a slap in the face. I realized that just about everything that I was taught was a lie. especially when it comes to Western medicine, that we are basically unplugged from our source, and that, personally, I view the plant as an equal and opposite reaction to a lot of horror that's going on in our world right now and a chance to heal a nation. But it's not just the plant that we're talking about. We're talking about recreational drug users that fall into these categories where they're going to be arrested, fingerprinted, and basically any hope for the future is taken.
Yes, no longer able to vote, use government housing, get an education, credit, job. Little wonder that the black market in drugs is the only organization hiring. It is a sad situation that we, America, land of second chances, is hardly the land of first chances anymore. We've been duped by those with money and power.
There's a book that came out very early on called The Emperor Wears No Clothes.
Jack Herer, you betcha.
Mm-hmm. And he was pretty on track at talking about the corporate involvement in the illegally, the prohibition of cannabis that started this war on drugs.
Right. It was what accelerated. It's what spread the hysteria, the propaganda, the fear. And they tried to convince people that this product that they had been using all their lives, that mankind had been using for thousands of years, the cannabis plant, which they made elixirs and lotions and all kinds of things from, but they were scared by the thought of this new, quote, drug from Mexico, down south, marijuana. And people said, well, yeah, that sounds like bad stuff. Well, I'll go along to protect the children, little realizing that it was the very same drug they were buying on the grocery shelf called cannabis. It's a big, well, I'm not going to say joke, but it's a big situation where we've been fooled.
Is there availability of, I imagine there is because this is all on the record, but of how many people, when they voted to prohibit the substance, really actually knew what they were voting for?
Well, that's the real ironic part of it. When these bills came through the U.S. Congress, they were rather confused. There was one of the congressmen talked about, I think it's some kind of narcotic. They said that the American Medical Association was in favor of this new law, when the fact of the matter is the American Medical Association had come before Congress to protest this law and to say they saw no reason why it should be passed. So it's a lie. It's been a lie. It will remain a lie until we end these stupid laws.
And there's people like you and I and all the activists that are trying actively to get the truth out there as more and more people fall ill and see that Western medicine isn't working for them. They're returning to the ground and the earth. They're finding that the cannabis does relieve a lot of these symptoms and cure most of these diseases.
Well, you see the reports Dr. Sanjay Gupta has put out, about weed and showing the little girls and the little children that suffering hundreds of seizures per day, and then they try some of the CBD oil or even just straight out marijuana extract, and the number of episodes disappears. Well, it doesn't disappear. From 300 a day, it might diminish to one or two per day or just a few per week, which allows the brain to relax, which allows them to learn or relearn how to walk and talk and communicate with their parents. And anybody who sees that and who still continues to believe in drug war, who believes that this marijuana should remain illegal, I truly believe they're evil or at best, wholly ignorant.
Our colleges don't teach the endocannabinoid system, which was rediscovered in 94, I do believe, but it's not taught in the medical schools. Someone has to really defend, this is what I paid for my education, they can't be wrong.
We have been duped. I mean, that's one of the first lines in my book, is that we have been duped. And we have allowed profiteers to take control of our educational system, medical learning, and we've allowed this to develop over the years because it was designed to protect the few, to protect the innocent, to protect the children. And as I stated, the drug war has never done anything to protect our children. It now is set up where it entices them to join in the black market, to make a little bit of dollars by selling drugs to their fellow students. The best place to buy drugs in America, high schools. Second best, junior highs. Third best, our prisons. We had a series of busts here in Houston just over the last month where jailers have been caught sneaking drugs and other products into the jails to make a few extra bucks. It is an enticement. It is a creator of crime.
as a creator of crime, but it's also a creator of a small industry that's within itself that keeps some people afloat. You know, I mean, it's sad but true. And we look at, you know, where our attorney general is making some recommendations, or at least has acknowledged that there's sentencing issues. There needs to be severe sentencing reform. There's a gentleman from Harrisonville sitting in prison for life, his third strike out, this time selling to an undercover officer 5 pounds of marijuana. But he's serving time alongside a former police officer that molested dozens of children that will get out in 20 years. Looking at the sentencing reform, they are taking it in small doses, which actually, or as you stated in your book, incrementalism is a killer.
Well, it took us 100 years from December 17, 1914, with the passage of the Harrison Narcotics Act to get to this point in time here. And luckily, we're starting to realize, to unwind the mechanism of drug war. But my thought, my hope, is that we don't take another 100 years to undo the drug laws themselves. I want to share a thought with you. I wrote a letter back earlier this month. I sent it to Barack Obama, Attorney General Holder, Senate Majority Minority Leaders, House Majority Minority Leaders, and our Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts. And the first line of the letter I sent to them, along with my book, was, "I write this day to beseech you to reconsider our nation's addiction to drug war." And it goes on to talk about slow, ugly, bloody nature of this drug war and how they should do their part to do something about it. And just Friday, I got a letter, U.S. Department of Justice, Drug Enforcement Administration, addressed to me. It's a brief letter. I'll read it to you. "Dear Mr. Becker, Attorney General Eric Holder asked me to thank you for sending him a copy of your book, To End the War on Drugs, A Guide for Politicians, the Press, and Public. He thought the Drug Enforcement Administration might find the book an interesting read, so he has shared it with us. Thank you for sharing this publication with us. Sincerely, Gary R. Owen, Acting Chief, Office of Congressional and Public Affairs." And some within reform have told me that I better watch it when I open the door. I think, no, from what I've heard and seen from Eric Holder, he understands this problem. He's spoken rather boldly about the need for change over the past, 6, 8, 10 months. And I think the end is, you know, like a glimpse of light at the end of the tunnel. It is there. It's waiting for us to march towards us. It's waiting for us to encourage and motivate these politicians to stand for truth. And I think we have this opportunity, and we'd best not blow it.
With the truth comes the fact that finances fund this war. It really does. There's militarization going on of police departments, with the drug war being the reason why, saying that this is equipment they need because the criminals are better equipped. And I can't see where a county would need, you know, Land Range Rovers and Humvees and 50 caliber guns to use on the citizens.
Right. And we have all of these surplus equipment coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, that they'd have to find a place to use it to justify the cost of the thing, I suppose. And they are giving it to counties and cities around the country that, get them a Humvee or anti-personnel carrier or whatever them vehicles are, mounted with machine guns and SWAT teams, 150 SWAT raids a day across this country, whereas it used to be when they first instituted SWAT teams, it was, one or two per year. It has become a means whereby they bust poker games and other places with, fully armed SWAT teams, just to justify the equipment, the expense, the personnel. We have been duped, and there's just so much wrong with the drug war that the public is beginning to recognize, is beginning to realize we have to do something about it, because we are slipping into this abyss that if we go much further, we may not be able to climb back out of.
Oh, definitely not. I mean, because it falls, and people get real aware when their family gets involved, when a grandmother has to raise their grandchildren because their children are incarcerated or have the children taken away from them, and then this, without a judge, jury, being arrested or tried because of the drug, get involved in this drug court, they take the kids, and then on their record goes a permanent mark that will keep them from ever working with children or getting their children back or working in nursing. All of this without being arrested, charged, or having representation. This happens in family court. That brings up a whole another set of issues where kids are being brought in. And of course, then as more people that work with each child, like a psychiatrist, and then they start with medications. And the more that people that they bring on, the more the paycheck comes in. Some kids have 6, 7, maybe even 8 caseworkers, you know, guardian ad litem, a psychiatrist, a social worker. There's a whole host of people that this kid employs. Then a whole team of people meet and take this power out of the parents' hands.
Too many of those situations were right for a bad urine test or, I don't know, trace amounts of drugs or just the thought that, you know, the neighbors are concerned and the police get involved and they take the kids, they put them in foster homes. And too often, those foster homes really don't care about those children. They just care about the paycheck that comes with keeping them. We had a horrible situation a few months back here where a gentleman got caught with some marijuana. They took his child. They gave it to a foster home and the foster mother killed the baby. And to protect the child from marijuana, they gave the child to, well, truthfully, a murdering foster parent. We have to get over the paranoia, the hysteria. We've got to get down to the heart of this matter. And as it's said a million times, marijuana has never killed anybody. It has never been a direct threat to the children. As I feel that if parents use a little cannabis to the end of the day to relax, unwind, and if they're not smoking it in front of the children or influencing them in some fashion, it should be no concern of government or anybody.
Well, it's the same as with them having a beer in front of the kids or pouring themselves cocktails in front of the kids. Should they be allowed to do that as well?
Right. You hear the objections, oh, we don't want to allow them to advertise weed to influence the children. Well, good Lord, as I said earlier, the schools are the place, the number one sales outlet for drugs to our kids. We have to get over that paranoia. It's fear of the unknown. Fear gives the drug war life. Without the fear, we would recognize the utter futility of continuing down this same path.
My daughter herself told me that when she was going to school and they try to make the officer friendly that's in their school around them and DARE, you know, the DARE program. She said learned how to use drugs from the DARE program. And whereas, you know, we've always been really open with her, and this was years ago, and this, you know, pretty much the DARE program is a fail.
Well, sure. And I'd like to, Jessica, point out again that this book talks about that fear, talks about solutions, talks about the reality of this. I mean, we've got chapters featuring judges and cops, doctors and medical cannabis experts. We've got a good friend of, I think, of yours, Mr. Eapen Thampy.
Oh, yeah.
He's in this book talking about money for nothing, you know, the asset forfeiture situation and how we set people up on the highways, pull them over for, quote, improper lane change or whatever, convince them that the cops convince the people they have the authority to dig through their trunk and under their seats and looking for that elusive drug bust, when really what they're looking for is money. Because if they can find a stack of money in your car, well, they're going to take it, telling you that, well, the only way you're going down the road is if you sign this release form. You know, that money mounts up. It's billions of dollars now per year being taken from Joe and Jolene's citizen because of the, quote, fear of drugs.
Those roadside stops, you know, being really very unconstitutional, but it seems like our Constitution is standing on pretty thin legs these days that our president and the Congress have taken away a lot of rights that we should have. Wireless tapping or you know, NSA, for instance.
Sure. Well, I've talked about many times that the war of terror, and, you know, a lot of folks say the war on terror, but no, it's a war of terror. There's terror inflicted on both sides of this, quite obviously. But the war of terror is the war on drugs with afterburners. After 9/11, they took the mechanism of drug war and immediately applied it to the war of terror, and then extrapolated and expanded it in the war of terror side, and then brought it back to the war on drugs side to further ratchet up the mechanisms and the means to go after our thoughts, our money, pretending to go after drugs. You know, I speak regularly for my band of brothers, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Just last week, I attended a Students for Sensible Drug Policy gathering at a local college, and it was amazing the questions that come forward are getting more professional or more educated, if you will, that people all across the country, heck, all around the world, are beginning to recognize or take a good look at the mechanism of drug war and are starting to form very profound opinions in that regard. And I think it's an opportunity to quell the fear of those because, as I say, fear gives the drug war life. If you get past the fear and look at the data, the information, the history, you begin to realize that there's no legitimacy to it. It needs to be undone.
And police are very, I mean, I know things have really shifted to where people are reluctant to call the police for help because they are no help. Someone goes to jail if someone calls for help, and it's usually the victim or someone in their family. Say if there's a murder. I know like in our area we have a little bit of restorative justice where they'll have someone from the restorative justice on the scene of the murder to try to assist the family because a lot of time there's that they want to retaliate against or they'll know who it was but be unwilling to speak with police because to them and just about everybody, the police can't be trusted. They're good. And I saw a great, it was really funny, it was how not to get your butt kicked, that wasn't the word, but how not to get your butt kicked by the police that a comedian had done. And it was funny, but it really isn't funny because it was true. You know, don't drive wearing your hat a certain way. Don't have certain items in your car. Don't talk back. Stay in your car. Keep your hands. But even that can't protect you. And it's got the fear is of the police. They have done that themselves. They've proven that they are violent. They harm people. And more people have been murdered by police in the United States than have been hurt by terrorists.
Well, and there you go. That's the heart of the matter is that, again, we have this mechanism in place. I mean, the airports, my gosh, what a joke these days. But the police have been given this largesse to circumvent, to walk around the Constitution because of necessity, you know, drugs, terror, whatever. And people just buy into it because of fear. And we have to stop and think about what does all this really mean? Are we that much in peril? Because of drugs, they've been around, well, since mankind started writing things down.
Right.
And yet, the hysteria just keeps pulsing out through the media, through the Congress, through, well, not the president so much. I think, I'm beginning to think that Obama and Holder get it. They are in a conundrum where it's hard to fight, quote, City Hall or you know, mechanisms of government that have been in place for so long.
Well, then City Hall makes the agreement when they bring in a new private prison that they will fill those prisons. They sign an agreement saying, you build here, we'll fill it.
A classic example right here in Houston. Mm-hmm. In the last couple of years, they've had jail overcrowding. It was unconstitutionally. They were shipping people to Louisiana because they just didn't have room. So they had a vote last November for building another jail, and mm-hmm. it passed. And the fact of the matter is, we have a law here in Texas that says you no longer have to arrest or jail anybody for under 4 ounces of marijuana. And yet the district attorney and the sheriff and the police chief say, no, 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 we're going to use the old law. And they continue to arrest every year over 10,000 people for under 4 ounces of marijuana, just in this city alone, which then leads to the jail overcrowding, which then led to the need to build a new jail. It's a scam, flim flam, has no basis in reality. It's a pipe dream. Did I hear something?
Yeah, that was me, Dean. We're getting really close to the end, so I've got to wrap it up here.
But Jessica, could I put in a request to people listening?
Sure, go
ahead. Anybody in the greater Kansas City area who knows someone who runs a bookstore, I would love to have my books on the shelf there. It's only on Kindle and Amazon at the moment. And I would like people to have access right there at a local bookstore. My email is dean@drugtruth.net. Send me a message. We'll make it happen.
You've been listening to The Jaws of Justice as we spoke with author Dean Becker. We could talk for hours on this and probably not run out of topics. To End the War on Drugs, A Guide for Politicians, the Press, and the Public is the title of the book. You're listening to KKFI.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following was borrowed from Morning Express. It features Dr. Sanjay Gupta. The discussion is revolving around the recent DEA ruling or non-ruling to reschedule marijuana.
What's not clear to me is, so what does this mean if you're somebody who's in a state that does allow medicinal marijuana?
That is a really important issue. The sort of one hand, you have the federal government saying one thing and many of the states saying something else. There aren't many issues that sort of fall into that pattern here. So there are times, even though the state has said it's okay, the feds could come in and say it's not. And that's been part of the problem here.
You know, when I have watched in the past your specials that highlight different families who claim medicinal use of marijuana has helped their loved one, be it a child, be it an adult, in different types or forms.
Yep.
The DEA said it found no therapeutic effects. What did your specials find?
Yeah, well, the DEA is saying, look, we find this to be the highest scheduled substance in the same category as LSD, as heroin, substances like that. We say it's highly addictive and has no medicinal benefit. That's what the Schedule 1 says. That's where they place marijuana. But you're right. There's been a lot of stories where people say, hey, look, it has benefited me. And what people have been saying is, let's allow it to be studied, right? Let's allow it to be studied like you'd study any other substance. But because of the scheduling, it's really hard to get that done. Today, what has happened is they said, look, more places can grow marijuana for study. We will make that more available. But the problem is, if it's still a Schedule 1, even if you make more available, it's still hard to get approval to study. And that's the problem. In fact, I think what will happen is that there's more places. Right now, there's only one place in the country that can grow federally approved marijuana. By the way, it's at the University of Mississippi in Oxford, Mississippi. It's the only place in the country. And a lot of researchers have been saying, you know, that's not enough. It's not diverse enough. You know, we need more places. So there's going to be other universities and other places that will now apply to be able to grow the marijuana on their properties. But again, even if you have more of it, if scientists have to go through all these hurdles to get approval for research,
right,
it may not actually accelerate research like people hope.
Is this ruling just about studying marijuana, just about if I want to grow it to study it? Because what if I'm Colorado and I got a whole lot of money tied up in what's called pot tourism?
Yeah. No, you know, so what I think a lot of people expected of this ruling was that it was going to be rescheduled, that they were no longer going to say it was highly addictive and has no medicinal benefit.
This is a bit of a surprise.
It is, I think, a bit of a surprise, and especially when you have the President of the United States who said, look, I don't consider this any more dangerous than alcohol. You've had Department of Health and Human Services officials basically saying, hey, look, this is one of those substances that we think is worthy of study. We even hold a patent on it in that regard. And one organization only, the DEA, keeps saying no.
It is my hope that the next president will appoint Dr. Sanjay Gupta as Surgeon General. Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
Ready? One, two, three. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not.
We hope you've enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and the guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, or its staff and volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio page on Facebook. If you have a show idea or you want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website at kkfi.org. This is your engineer for Jaws of Justice Radio, Beth Pike. And be sure to tune in Thursday mornings at 6 a.m. when I host the Thirsty Thursday edition of your Morning Buzz. Our outro music is Better Man, and that's from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Khadija and the White Guy at 9 a.m. on Thursdays, and then Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 on Fridays. Up next is Beautician's Blues. That's with Luscious Lynn. And then at noon, it's Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. You'll want to stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon, and then Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo en Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.